welcome to the What You've Been Watching podcast. I am your host, the marvelous Mike Dudley, joined as always by my co-host, cohort, youngest brother. He was brought to life by a magical top hat.
MD3 Marcus Dudley checking in on the YOU. What is going on out there in the holiday season in podcast land? We are broadcasting live from the North Pole here at What You've Been Watching Studios North, you know?
Super North.
Super North. You can always find us at whatchabeenwatchinpodcast@gmail.com. We are certainly on both lists somehow, the naughty and the nice list. But, you know, you can join our nice list by writing us in at whatchabeenwatchinpodcast@gmail.com. Where else can they find us, my brother?
You can find us online, Instagram at whatchabeenwatchin or facebook.com/Dudley Bros Podcast.
Just look for the colorful banner done by the great MK Dudley Art.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Also, big shout out to Ketza for the intro music, although maybe this one was A1. I don't know.
We'll probably A1 it.
All right. That's cool. Either way, shout out to both of you guys.
Shout out to A1. The man's a quadruple threat. He's he sings, he raps, he does beats, he even dances. That's four already. He's a sextuple threat. We got two more, Michael?
Two more. I heard he was a hell of a chimney sweep, and he was the guy that colorized Wizard of Oz.
Oh, there you go. He's also hell of a worker elf for Santa. I have it on good authority. Well, how are you, though, man?
I'm good. You know, holiday season and whatnot.
Yeah. Flying through the intros just to talk about it. You broke from spending money on people?
I was broke before I started spending money on people. So, yeah. I just tried to focus on the kiddos this year. Just make sure, you know, nieces, nephews, and various little childrens in my life had what they needed. And then, you know, a little something for the adult. You know, a little ting, if you will.
A little ting, small thing.
Little small
not
ting.
A proper package, but... Yeah. No, I get it, man. It gets tough because it's like I really do want to monetarily express my appreciation for people.
Right.
But it does at a certain point being like, man, this is kind of at my own detriment.
See, and that here's my problem is like I genuinely am the type of person, if I find something that I think somebody in my life would like, I just get it for them. And I'll just, you know, I mean, I've given you gifts just randomly throughout the year. Just like, hey, I just saw this online and thought you would dig it, you know?
Yeah, we've been on that tip since I came back to Florida, though.
Yeah.
We were just like, oh, I just saw this. Whatever. It's not even a thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not even a holiday, I meant. Like, we'll just get it.
Right. So, I don't know. So, I sort of justify the not purchasing a lot of gifts and stuff for people on Christmas by that. You know,
it's what I've never been mad. If I get a gift, it's cool. I just get a card. If I get a handwritten piece of paper, hey, love you, Merry Christmas. Like, oh, right. Thanks, man. Appreciate
right.
it.
Right. Right. Exactly.
The older you get, the less it means. But it is weird, though, because there is some odd sense of obligation. You know what I mean? Maybe like ingrained in us to like go out and stimulate the economy, buy and purchase, do your job as a consumer.
Well, yeah. I mean, we're children of the 80s, dude. All it was is just buy. Look at this new toy. Ooh, now Malibu Stacy has
get
a hat.
Buy it. You got to buy him some Pokemon. We did collect them all. Oh, well, anything else going on, man?
That's pretty much it, man. Just work has been kicking me right in the taint.
Catering, I'm sure.
Oh, just events. So many. It's holiday parties and end of year parties, and just I mean, it's one of the busiest times in the restaurant industry. Just because
when you escape to the front of the house to get drinks or whatever, do you often see drunk CEOs or drunk people at these office parties that are just like it is probably the same spiel over and over? I just want to say how much I appreciate you, and you hear the word family a lot.
That's right.
We're a family here at Corporation 2, and it's like, man, I'm sure you probably heard the same shit over and over. Which, by the way, for those of us on the other side of when you hear the family thing. We just register you saying family as ways for you to cross personal boundaries of
that's
ours
right,
as an employer.
Right.
So dial that shit back a little bit, man.
If your corporate masters are calling you family, that means they're going to try and pull some sketchy shit on you in the next 30 days.
Yeah, just take advantage of you. Well, we're family.
Well, like, okay.
Pay my houseboat bills? Right. No. Okay, then family.
That's right.
Granted, I don't do that for my family.
You're going to watch my dog for me?
Yeah.
Come bail me out.
Yeah, for real. For real. But enough of that. That's why we do what we do here at the What You've Been Watching podcast is to not talk about such things except for the opening segment. All that being said, time to pivot. my brother, the reason why people tune in, tune out, month in, month out, holiday season after holiday season, the people need to know, my brother. What you been watching, my guy?
My brother, I, of course, have been on the holiday tip. So started things off by watching the classic Rankin and Bass, Frosty the Snowman.
Oh, yeah? Is that Rankin and Bass?
It is Rankin and Bass.
Nice. What'd you think about it?
I don't know why we watched this as children.
What about it?
It's not great.
I mean, the song's repeated, like, incessantly.
That part. It's just an excuse to stretch a 3-minute song into 22 minutes.
Give me the rundown plot-wise, because, I mean, obviously, so basically, the magic, they build a snowman, the top hat comes, they put it on his head, he begins to dance around.
This magician is doing magic at an elementary school. He's a bad magician. Things keep going wrong, whatever, and he blames it on his top hat, throws it out the window. The kids find it, put it on Frosty. He comes to life. You know, happy birthday. Hey, I just realized I said my first words.
Oh, yeah.
You know, one of those deals. Anyway, magician sees that the snowman has now come to life, wants to get his top hat back, and so the kids decide that since the temperature is now rising into the mid-70s, although they just built a snowman that morning, never mind, global warming, they decide that the best thing to do is to get Frosty to the North Pole where he can stay alive forever, whatever.
As long as he has a top hat.
As long as he has a top hat, I guess, sure.
Yeah, I kind of forgot the events of it. I knew it was just, like I said, a 3-minute song stretched into an absurd runtime.
I mean, the magician does try to murder a little girl at one point. So,
really?
I mean,
he Dick Dastardly's it?
I mean, not necessarily ties her to the train tracks, but the further they get north, she gets sick and gets hypothermia, and he's like, he comes across their campsite and he snuffs out the fire so she'll get sicker.
Oh, man. just stab me, please. Like, what are we doing here? No, I didn't realize that. Yeah, I haven't seen that one in a while, but every time I walk past certain like department stores or whatever like that around a certain time, they're always playing it. So I've been watching segments of that 22-minute show,
sure, right,
off and on for a long time, but I don't think I've seen it beginning to end in many years.
I gotta be honest, man, as far as holiday classic cartoons go, it doesn't really hold up. There's not a whole lot of there.
I mean, I think some of these things are classics just because they just are. They just kind of got doctored in because it was just something that was played for so long.
Yeah.
And granted, back then there was only, you know, 3 channels. It's like, you got ABC, right. NBC, and CBS or whatever like that. And
yeah,
so,
I think Frosty was licensed by CBS, and they had it, I think the first showing was in like 1968, 1969, something like that. And they literally, if you want to watch Frosty the Snowman, you had to tune in on a certain day at a certain time, specifically to CBS, because they weren't going to show it again for another 360, you know, 5 days.
Yeah, that is true. I remember even just being as a kid trying to tune in for like the holiday specials or whatever like that. Especially like, they got a little easier with cable because then certain networks would play at certain times. But There was a big deal. You would see it like 2 weeks in advance being like,
this
Sunday at 7,
right.
Yep. Rudolph the all-time classic, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Followed by it, you know, Santa Claus is Coming to Town. And then on NBC you had, you know, How the Grinch Stole Christmas. And CBS had Frosty the Snowman and, you know, whatever.
I am just like, it is true though, because like I appreciate, you know, I'm willing to call them classics too. I'm not trying to take a shot, but like we had talked last episode about like The Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown,
mm-hmm.
and how they're all just kind of uneventful. And like if that cartoon were to come out today, like just as is, you'd be like, this is trash.
Sure.
I know that the game has changed and that's part of it. You have to view it through a retroactive lens or whatever like that. But like a lot of that stuff, if it did come out today, would not hold up. But yet we still consider it to be a classic.
Well, because attention spans now are so minimally short, you know, like you don't basically those shows existed so that they could sell more crap to you during the commercial breaks. You know, it was all these billion-dollar corporations being like, oh, we want to buy time during, you know, It's a Wonderful Christmas, Charlie Brown, because we know that we're going to have, you know, 6.8 million people watching it, you know, that specific program. Like,
yeah,
we have the numbers to back it up.
No, I get all that. I mean, that's kind of the whole, you know, you create ad revenue. But I'm just saying, like, in terms of classics, like, it is weird what we consider to be a classic given modern standards. So I can agree with you on that one.
Yeah.
But do you want to review it, or you want to keep talking about it, or?
I'm going to give it Not Enough Killer Snowmen.
Boppity, bop, bop, boppity, bop, bop. Gonna find you in your sleep.
It's no Jack Frost, I'll tell you that much.
Jack Frost is the truth. It took me everything not to review that movie yet again. So, anyways. Well, what else you been watching, my guy?
Let's see. After that, I watched another holiday perennial classic, Dr. Seuss's How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
This is getting up there with Adam's Family territory.
I mean, in my opinion, that's if you're going to do an animated Christmas thing, do that.
It is the best one. It is.
And here's the problem. This is why none of the long-term movies have worked out. You know what I mean? Like, they did the Jim Carrey thing. I think Benedict Cumberbatch did an animated one or something like that.
You know who directed that?
Who did it?
The Grinch one?
Yeah.
A producer that used to work with Kevin Smith.
Oh, Scott Mosier?
Yeah.
Did he really?
Yep.
Okay. Okay. Right on.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I did not know that.
It's actually not bad. It's not the typical story. It's more just about the Grinch. It's the same story beats happen. He steals Christmas, whatever.
Of course.
But like, there's a little more to it. But it's not bad. It's just, it's hard to compare when you're animating the Grinch to the animated Grinch.
Well, but the thing about the Chuck Jones animated, you know, classic is that it's 22 minutes, you know? It's you're in, you're out. The entire book of How the Grinch Stole Christmas is only 69 pages. So,
well, it's got to be less than that.
I think it is. I think it's
Either way. It's I get what you're saying.
It only sticks in my mind because of 69.
Okay.
So.
Hey, look. Or he just has 69 on the brain.
Yeah. Welcome to the ladies, man.
Yeah. Welcome to the Christmas, man. I'm here to stuff your stockings with your holiday queries.
Welcome to what you've been skanking.
There you go. But yeah, where were we? I'm sorry.
22 minutes. It's in, it's out. Yeah. The problem with the long-term movies is that they try to add too much fluff to it. They try to pad out the runtime, and it's all just chuffa. It doesn't matter. There's nothing that it contributes to the story in any way other than Grinch hates Christmas, steals Christmas trees, takes them all back to his secret lair, finds out, oh, wait, maybe there's something more to this Christmas than just stuff.
Yeah, I mean, Jim Carrey is pretty good as the Grinch.
Yeah, I'm not denying that. But
his role as the Grinch is
pretty good. Need to know his whole backstory and how he grew up, you know, the misshapen figure, you know, the leopard in a field of zebras?
Yeah, you did. 'Cause relation, buddy. So I guess what the Grinch does is the opposite of Frosty the Snowman. They took a small book and added a 3-minute song.
Yes.
And then Frosty took a 3-minute song and stretched it into a 22-minute show. And it only works one way, apparently.
Exactly. Yeah. But and then of course, you know, you have Chuck Jones, who is just probably one of the greatest animators. In fact, in my notes I have written down, hold on, let me read it for you. In my notes I have written down, for some reason this came as a newspaper headline in my head. Chuck Jones declared the GOAT of animators. Miyazaki self-immolates in protest.
More on Miyazaki later. Yeah, that's pretty funny. I don't know why that came to you. It was
a
news headline.
Yeah. Anywho, I don't know how much more I can say about it. Boris Karloff is great. The song is catchy as hell and probably one of the greatest Christmas tunes ever written.
It has, okay, for those of us, we'll try to maybe attach the link to the Dudley's 12 Days of Christmas that the incomparable MD4 did.
That's right.
Who's MD4, do you ask? Maddie Dutz did a documentary on a tradition we have at the Dudley household, which we will try to attach the link to one of these. But one of the newer things that we've done is, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, all the younger generation got up and sang The Grinch.
Mm-hmm, right.
And that's kind of been the thing. It's got to be the younger generation, too, to get up and sing the Grinch song. So, coming to a holiday season near you, the dulcet tones of the Dudley Boys singing, "You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch." We'll cross those bridges.
One day.
Yeah, I'll rate this movie as high as it can possibly go. It's my favorite holiday movie, period.
Really?
Yeah, full stop.
Okay.
That's my, like, when you talk about Christmas traditions, there's two things I can't, it can't Christmas until I need it to happen. I can't even watch the Grinch until I see Pinky come in and declare Merry Christmas.
On Friday after next. Friday after next, right.
When he declares that, then I can begin to Christmas. Once I can then Christmas, I can then listen to, or I can then watch the Grinch.
Okay.
So, yeah. So that's okay. That's the order for me. And I listen to Donny Hathaway's This Christmas Quarterly, so I get that in just before Halloween, just so I can start Christmas caroling on my own terms.
Oh, God, no.
Yeah, I do. But it's on my own terms, though, so it's like I don't want Mariah Carey to sneak up on me when I'm not listening. And all I want for Christmas is you, me. So I get mine in early, big dog. It's actually a pretty smart plan, but we've talked about that before.
Oh, great.
So anyways, what else you been watching?
Let's see. After that, I saw the classic Christmas caper, Christmas with the Cranks. That was very alliterative.
I saw what you were going for there. Good job. Good job. Is it a classic? That's what, Tim Allen and Jamie Lee Curtis?
Yes, sir.
Never seen it.
Guest starring Dan Aykroyd and I'm trying to think who else was in there. There was somebody else that caught my eye. Oh, you know who it was?
Who?
It was Rickety Cricket.
Wait, really?
Yeah, Father Matty, Rickety Cricket.
Oh, what's his name?
Doesn't matter, Rickety Cricket.
Oh, damn it. If you wouldn't ask me his name. David Hornsby.
David Hornsby, yes.
Yeah. Got
he
it.
Shows up as one of the neighbors, and like immediately I was like, Rickety Cricks!
Rickety Cricks! Yeah, awesome. No, you know, we always appreciate when people from our TV show show up. Like we've mentioned it a million times. Well, I certainly have. When somebody from Reno 911 shows up in anything.
Yeah.
Or like the Workaholics boys show up in something. I'm like, oh, it's fucking... It's Durs or it's Blake. Yeah. It's out or whatever. So always good when that happens. So what did you think about Christmas with the Cranks? I'm sure I've probably seen it in the background of some TNT being left on somewhere or something.
The basic synopsis is Tim Allen and Jamie Lee Curtis's daughter leaves for Christmas. She joined the Peace Corps, and so she's going to be working like Peru or Argentina or something like that for over Christmas. So they decide last minute, we're just going to skip everything Christmas. We're not doing gifts, not setting up a tree, not decorating anything, no boughs of holly, no nothing. We're going to go on a cruise to the Bahamas, and that's going to be our Christmas. We're just going to avoid everything. The problem is that they live in a neighborhood where everybody's into Christmas, like in a weird culty sense, like almost like Village of the Damned type stuff.
like the HOA that you from hell kind of thing, the homeowners association. Christmasing and you're didn't paint your pickets white.
Kind of.
This is more of an eggshell white. We like.
But it gets to the point where there's literally, I mean, Dan Aykroyd is literally chasing down Jamie Lee Curtis's car as she's trying to drive away. Like, just put up your Frosty. Just put up your plastic Frosty. Just a little bit of lights. And, like, running alongside the car, like, trying to break into the car kind of thing.
Yeah, bro.
It was kind of sketch. Like, it's this weird, like, I don't know. Like, it's over the top and it's cartoonish. And I suppose it's meant to be. But it's also very awkward. Like, I would just start shooting people. I would just get the fuck off my lawn and just... Clint Eastwood, every single one of them.
Yeah, you're going to make me Bah Humbug, and I don't even want to.
That's right. So, I don't know. The thing that I liked about it, I mentioned it was kind of over the top and cartoonish. I'd seen it before, but I never noticed. They do so many cartoon sound effects in this movie. I mean, there's literally a point where somebody slips on the ice, and they do like, whoa!
Oh, man.
The whoop, 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 whoop sound. Yeah, exactly. I mean... There's a scene where Jamie Lee Curtis goes to pull somebody's earplugs out, and you know they make the popping sound.
Oh man, this is full on Disney mode.
Yeah. It's kind of, it's humorous. I don't know that it's ever going to be a Christmas classic, but it's worth a watch. They're both doing a lot of really good physical comedy. Tim Allen, especially. I think he's doing more physical comedy, but Jamie Lee Curtis is much more entertaining to watch. Just her facials throughout the entire thing is very, very animated.
Yeah, it's weird when we say that word classic. Like now everyone is so quick to throw out the word like... The GOAT. This person's the GOAT. Like, everyone's a GOAT in the rap game now. Everyone's a GOAT in sports now, the greatest of all time or whatever. But the one thing I will say is that all of these movies, these holiday ones, they get, played, around this time of the year or ad nauseum at points. That is somebody's favorite. because it was one of their first ones, and the nostalgia attached to it can't be quantified.
Right.
Of like, oh, I remember, you know, I was in kindergarten, and then I came home, and we sat around and watched Christmas with the Cranks, and we drank hot chocolate.
Right.
So that's why these things are so, like, perpetually just shown and reshown, and then you see them pop back up, and, like, it wasn't available a month ago in October, and then when November hits on your local streaming service, they'll start to show up.
Right. So a lot of it has to do with your own personal history, you know? Like, I'm sure there's people out there who have seen The Grinch before and are like, I don't fucking get this at all. Like, what am I watching? Why this? Like,
yeah.
Or, you know, there's people who watch, you know, Love Actually every year, and I'm like, I don't get that one at all. Meanwhile, I cry every single year at It's a Wonderful Life. So,
yeah.
Go figure. I know full well watching that movie, I'm going to be bawling my eyes out by the time he comes through and he's like, Merry Christmas, Bedford Falls.
What was the first movie you remember crying at?
Showgirls. No. First movie I remember crying at? I don't know, man. That's... I'm sure as a little kid, like maybe when Bambi's mom got shot or something like that, but I don't know. First movie I remember crying at?
I can tell you mine, and I don't even remember the scene. Okay. Actually, I can tell you the scene. There was the redhead kid that was one of the bullies in, what's the movie? The other Christmas movie, the one with the leg stocking. You'll shoot your Christmas
Story. Oh, Christmas Story, yeah.
One of the kids, I think the red-haired kid, it's one of his, it might be him. There was a movie called Angus.
Okay.
And I don't remember what it was about. I'm going to look it up at some point and I'll get back to you on this.
No, that was about the little fat kid getting bullied and stuff.
Yeah. And his
kind of loser. It's kind of like pre-Napoleon Dynamite.
Yeah,
like
a little bit
loserish.
Yeah, and I think it was a moment where like he wins like Homecoming King, or he goes to ask a girl out, and that little redhead kid goes like, "Go for it, Angus," and he says it so sincerely. And I remember watching that movie when we rented it by myself, like I was to entertain me, and I ended up like welling up at that. And that was the first time as a kid I was like, "You manipulated my emotions via screen," and I may have done it before that. But I remember that was the first time that I was like, what just happened? So,
yeah, I honestly couldn't
tell. I'll never forget, the scene is locked in my head, his delivery, everything. And I was just like, whoa.
What was the thing? Was it just the sincerity of like,
I don't know.
The brotherhood behind him, like supporting his dude.
Yeah. And just seeing this kid win, I guess, like this kid needed a win. And I am pretty like, I don't like bullies and I don't like stuff like that. And
you are constantly rooting for the underdog.
Yeah, and so I don't know what it was, but it was something about that scene on that day and that moment, and maybe just not expecting it. So, anyways, that was a long tangent after you brought up crying at A Wonderful Life. But just a little inside to me. I'm going to go rewatch the movie Angus and do a deep dive here in the near future, all right? We'll do it, all right?
Yeah, we should do that. And
whichever your answer is.
What was the one where they went to fat camp, the Heavyweights?
That movie was funny, though. Didn't that have Curtis Lloyd in it?
Goldberg?
Oh, that did have Goldberg. Yeah. No, what was the one? Whatever. Well, we're going off on a tape. Anyway. But no, we'll rewatch Angus and we'll get back to you on that one. And but yeah, so you were talking about
Christmas with the Cranks.
With the Cranks.
So
way long tangent there. Sorry.
Yeah. So then the movie midway through makes this weird shift where all of a sudden now the daughter calls up and she's like, hey, by the way, our project got canceled due to whatever, I forget, but like, you know, budget cuts or whatever. So I'm coming home for Christmas and I'm bringing home my boyfriend who I met in Bolivia and we're probably going to get married. And so now the movie shifts from the entire neighborhood trying to pressure the Cranks to put up their Christmas stuff to now they have to scramble in 24 hours to put on the best Christmas ever in order to impress their daughter.
Yeah, that is a weird pivot.
It's a
terms of being diametrically opposed.
Yeah. I mean, especially because the first one is so, I mean, the first half is a little bit dark, you know, it's very obsessive. I mean, there's literally a point where the neighborhood is on the lawn, you know, on their lawn, like chanting, give us Frosty, because they're the only house in the neighborhood that hasn't put up their like 12-foot-tall plastic Frosty the Snowman.
And they all are clamoring for Frosty.
Because they want the neighborhood to be uniform and, you know, like, we'll even put it up for you. Give us Frosty.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is, besides the obvious, like, family on the holidays. Like, what's the moral of this? Because it just seems like we hate Christmas, but it's necessary. Like, I don't, how do they, again, outside of the typical, like, that I can guess, like, home for the holidays where you are and, you know, your family's, which is where you're supposed to be for Christmas kind of thing. Like, what's the moral? What's the over, like, what am I supposed to take away with it? You hate Christmas, but then you can be pressured into it. And then because you want to be fake for your daughter, I don't know. Like, what's the moral here?
That's a very good question, sir. I don't know what it's trying to tell me because it's there's so many new plot devices. I mean, they end up introducing this burglar who somehow works his way into the house, and then he gets caught by this little kid, and the kid's like, but it's Christmas, so I'm going to trust that this was just a mistake. And then he goes right back to stealing their shit. And then,
yeah, kid, me pocketing this diamond ring is a definite mistake that will never happen again.
That's right. So, yeah, it's, yeah, all of a sudden it becomes this like burglary story. And then they try to work in the magic of Santa Claus through this weird pseudo, I don't know. It's, I don't know what it's telling me. It's basically telling me that I think it's about togetherness and sort of everybody coming together for the holidays, but the reason why they come together is so shallow and hollow.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, well, we don't want our daughter to think that we lost the Christmas spirit. So it's really important that we pull this off, and oops, there's only one ham left in the store. So now I got to fight an old lady for it.
Now we got to eat cold cuts.
That's right.
Fried bologna.
So, yeah. So in the end, the whole neighborhood comes together and everybody kind of donates a little bit of their Christmas to help the cranks put on the best Christmas ever. So I guess it's sort of also the spirit of giving, but also fuck you guys. You tried to break into my house and set up Christmas decorations against my will.
Yeah. It's like being a part of a community, but also, I don't get it. That's why I was curious. I was like, the switch is not that it's a weird switch plot line wise, like, oh, we're doing this and now we got to do, but like just the diametrically opposed of like, well, what was the first half for?
It's not even like a gear shift. It's like you switched cars. Yeah, midway, it's like a different through.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's why I was saying, like, how do they stick the landing on that one? Like, but, oh, look at what we did for you and your boyfriend, which we really didn't want to do, but like, I guess it's important to her, the daughter, maybe, I would assume, right?
Christmas? Sure. Why not?
Yeah, whatever. Like, made me cancel my cruise. I could have been
exactly that.
Drinking margaritas in the Bahamas right now. Anyways.
Yeah. So, it's worth it for, like I said, there's some really good physical comedy. I think that Tim Allen's doing some really good work. Although I will say Jamie Lee Curtis is, I think, by far the more entertaining of the two to watch.
I could see that.
Yeah.
She's pretty entertaining, period.
Yeah, yeah. She does rely a little bit on her whole scream queen gig. Like, she just sort of looks at the camera and pulls a Janet Leigh, you know, like, ah!
Yeah. I mean, she mastered that in Freaky Friday.
Yeah.
You know.
That's another great movie.
Yeah, we'll watch that soon. So what would you
review? They're making a sequel of that?
Yeah, they're redoing it.
Yeah, Freakier Friday or Freakiest Friday.
That's what I'm talking about.
Freak on Friday.
Freak Nick Friday. That'd be a very Friday, different there we go. Set freak, in Atlanta.
Freak like this. I'm a freak. Freak, oh, freak like this.
A Freak Nick Friday would be set in Atlanta. In the mid-90s. Patent pending. Don't write that movie. Michael and I are going to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, me, you, and T-Pain.
Hey, it's a good idea, actually.
Also, T-Pain, please.
We love you. Welcome back to Tallahassee, sir. So what would you review Christmas with the Cranks?
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to give it 11 plot lines going, 10 frosty snowmen, 9 more things to go.
All right. Nice work. Anything else you have been watching for the holiday sneezing?
After that, I watched another Christmas classic.
Oh, man. You really, he likes the word Christmas classics.
Surviving Christmas.
Never heard of this.
So
probably have, but
long story short is Benny Affleck hires James Gandolfini's family to be his fake family through the Christmas season so that he can work through some childhood trauma.
Okay. So rich boy hires family to take his shit out on for Christmas.
Pretty much.
Okay. Well, expand upon this, please.
All right. So basic plot summary is Ben Affleck plays this guy named Drew, who is this billion-dollar I want to say marketing executive or account executive, something to do with advertising.
A big wig?
A big wig, if you will. Who his girlfriend breaks up with him the like 2 or 3 days before Christmas, and he has to cancel his trip to Fiji, whatever. And so he's scrambling to find purpose during Christmas. And so he decides to go visit his childhood home and just sort of like drive by. And like his therapist told him to write down all of his grievances on a piece of paper, go to some place that has a lot of nostalgia and light it on fire. So he goes to his childhood home. As he's lighting it on fire, the new owner of the house, James Gandolfini, comes out, you know, Jimmy Gandolf's, comes out and hits him in the head with a shovel. After that, now he has an in with the family, so he decides to make it up to them. He's going to offer them $250,000 to pretend to be his family for Christmas.
Just the day?
No. It starts 3 days before Christmas, and it ends Christmas Day at midnight.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, still either way. Sign me up.
Yeah, so like I said, James Gandolfini is the dad. Catherine O'Hara is the mom.
She's awesome.
And then Christina Applegate shows up later as the daughter. They also have a son named Brian, but I don't know who the actor is. But he is the one to watch, man.
Really?
This poor kid just gets continually shat on by everybody. Just everybody is messed with. He keeps getting Milton's, you know, like Milton from Office Space.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
We need you to move your desk.
I'm so glad that that's become a term that people understand.
Right, right. But same thing happens to him with his sleeping arrangement. Like when Ben Affleck shows up, part of the contract is he gets to sleep in his old room, which is Brian's room.
It's Josh Zuckerman, is apparently
there we go.
Brian Valco.
There we go.
Just want to give a shout out.
Yeah. So he gets to go sleep in the guest room. And then when Christina Applegate, the daughter, shows up, she gets the guest room. So he has to go sleep on the couch. Then Ben Affleck brings in this play actor to play his granddad, his Duda. And so then Duda gets the couch and Brian gets moved to the garage.
Oh,
and then
man.
Duda's understudy shows up. And so now he's sleeping on a rack with Duda's understudy.
It's cold-blooded, so, man.
He's just constantly, just every time he's like, I hate these people. I hate these people so goddamn much.
How much of this 250 grand am I getting?
Right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So, I mean, it's a funny premise, but it gets really weird because all Ben Affleck does is just interfere in these people's lives. Like at one point he gives them scripts that he wrote to have this perfect dinner conversation. Like, gee, honey, I sure am glad that you managed to cook this beautiful dinner for us. You sure do work hard keeping the house clean. And she's like, I'm an accountant. I go to work, you know, like whatever. He's like, just stay on script. You know, I think we should all hold hands and say blessing, you know, and everybody's kind of awkwardly looking around. And meanwhile, Ben Affleck's like, we hold hands when we pray in this family.
Nice. He's such a ham, dude.
I mean,
I like Ben Affleck a lot.
I gotta say, Ben Affleck is beautifully unhinged in this. I mean, he's swinging for the fences. He's annoying as fuck, and you hate him through the entire movie, but he's still kind of got that Ben Affleck charm.
Yeah, it's kind of his whole thing right there.
I mean, the level of entitlement that he has in this movie, I'm not sure that $250,000 would be able to put up with the smug that just surrounds him, you know? Just the aura of like,
good pull.
So, good pull. I don't know. It's like this rich white guy comes in, tries to buy off this family, interferes with their lives. Sometimes a little helpful, but it's only because he's just giving them money, you know? Like,
yeah, that is helpful.
I mean, like, but there's a certain air of, just because you pay people doesn't mean that you have the right to treat them however you want. Like, at some point, you're putting a price on their dignity. It's like, okay, like, there's people that go to a restaurant and they just treat the server staff like shit. You know what I mean? Or
yes.
Like, they make all these demands, or they're impatient, you know, nothing's coming out right, nothing's coming out on time, you know, it's, or they come in with 20 of their friends and expect to get seated right away, and then they're upset when they have a 30-minute wait to wait for tables to clear or something like that.
Yeah.
And then their excuse is always what? You know, like, oh, well, I tip them good. And it's like, well, yes, but you at that point are putting a price on their humanity, and sometimes that price doesn't match up with what they believe is the price on their humanity. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes it's priceless. Sometimes you just can't pay people enough to treat them like shit.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. As long as the terms of agreement are, I'm going to treat you this way, but you're going to be, I mean, for lack of a better term, like prostitution. Like, at least you know what you're getting into, you know, or should before it happens. But to a certain extent of just like, the two don't have to be mutually exclusive. You can pay me to perform a service and not treat me like shit in the process of performing right. that service, even if the service is naturally degrading in its nature or whatever, you know, or subservient in its nature. Like, you don't have to fucking, I can shovel shit. Hey, I'll pay you $10,000 to shovel shit, my sure. shit. Okay, fair. It's already degrading in its nature. I don't need you sitting at the top of the ditch going, you piece of crap, look right, at you. Like, right. you know
shoveling
what I mean?
Shit for a living.
Yeah, so I get what you mean. But so, yes. But if the terms are agreement of like, yes, and I'm going to harass you ahead because I gets off on it or whatever, like, okay, then you know. But I don't know. I'm with you on it, though. I know that's a long way for me to agree with you, but...
Yeah, I mean, there's a scene where Catherine O'Hara is, you know, making him a hot chocolate. And he, by contract, he's allowed to call everybody mom and dad and, you know, brother, whatever. Christina Applegate shows up and he's like, well, this ruins everything because I never had a sister. But like, you can be the Colombian maid, you know. So every time she tries to speak up, you know, he's telling her like, si, Consuelo, silencio, por favor.
Oh, Lord.
Five aguas, you know. So just totally disrespectful. Anyway.
Yeah, no, that's a good example of it, though.
But
yeah.
So there's a scene where Catherine O'Hara is making him a hot chocolate, and he's like, oh, thanks, Mom. I really appreciate it. And, you know, she hands him the mug, and he goes, yeah. My real mom put a peppermint candy cane in this. So try again. And he hands it back to her, and she's like, all right, well, here. She goes and pulls a candy cane from some random drawer, pops it in, hands it back to him. He's like, nah, my real mom used to put marshmallows in mine with the candy cane because it would mix together and, you know, it was real sugary and sweet and I loved it. Okay, try again. So she throws in a handful of marshmallows. Yeah, my mom would use the mini marshmallows. So she just pulls out a cleaver and starts smashing the marshmallows into tinier bits and just shovels them in. He's like, I mean, I guess it'll do. And it's just shit like that, yeah. You know. Or like, there's a scene where James Gandolfini and him go Christmas tree shopping. And he's like, hey, so my dad used to always wear this Santa hat when he went Christmas shopping, you know. And of course, Jimmy Gandolf's is like, nah, I'm not going to wear the hat.
I like your impression.
Well, how about I give you an extra $5,000? He's like, fine, fucking. And he starts mumbling himself. He's like, $250,000, $250,000, $250,000. You know, just trying to put up with his shit.
Yeah.
You know, just trying to focus on like, just need the money. That's fine. Anyway, so long story short, Christina Applegate comes home unexpectedly. He ends up falling in love with Christina Applegate. And there's this weird will they, won't they, where he's still being an asshole to her. And he treats her like, yeah, but I own you kind of thing. But also, you kind of cute.
May I make a pitch real quick?
Sure.
Unrelated to the movie, but also related to the movie?
Sure.
Christina Applegate?
Uh-huh.
What you been watching, Wall of Fame?
I mean, for...
A litany of things.
Married with Children Alone.
Yeah, okay, well, we're in agreements. Welcome.
Don't tell Mom the babysitter's dead.
Welcome to Anchorman, yes.
Oh, Anchorman.
She's a G. She's a certified G. All right, well, welcome to the What's Been Watching Wall of Fame, Christina Applegate. Right. Awesome. Anyways, please proceed.
Yeah. But no, congratulations to you, Tits McGee.
I love Ron Bergen. He's like, I'm Tits McGee. It's one of my favorite scenes. But no, to your point, though, it is something about, like, there is a contract in terms of, like, when you work for an employer of, like, I don't necessarily need an attaboy for every single thing that I do because that is the contract. You're paying me to do this thing, so when I do the thing you're paying me to do, I don't need to be rewarded for it. But at the same time, you can't treat people like shit because if we all say, well, we're not doing this anymore, the terms are unfair. Mm-hmm. Like, you officially aren't a business owner anymore.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so there has to be some of that too. Like, if we all walk out of here, you're officially not a business. You have a title and a business with no employees.
Why, Marcus, that sounds awfully pro-union.
It sure is. It sure is.
Not to politicize.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, it's kind of the same thing, though. Like, if we all bail on this operation.
Right. What do you got?
Yeah. Then your whole trauma bond experiment that you're doing here, it's got to be give and take to a certain degree. So, I don't know. I'm with you on it.
Like I said, it's a weird dynamic because he does kind of help them out. Like, it turns out that James Gandolfini and Catherine O'Hara are like on the verge of divorce, and he pays for this high-end New York photo shoot to be done for her. He ends up buying him, you know, a T-Bird or some like muscle car or whatever, because it's the one he's always wanted. Or I'm sorry, he had one before he had kids, and then he had to get rid of it.
And he resents her for it.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's an interesting concept. Like, it's an original idea, at least.
I mean, it's a little bit like, did you ever see the Richard Pryor movie, The Toy?
Oh, I think on Comedy Central at one point. But
I mean, basic premise is that this little kid wants a human plaything, and so he buys a black man to be his personal toy and do whatever he wants.
Yeah, it's problematic.
Yeah, you think?
Yeah. No, I don't think I saw that one.
Yeah, it's, I mean, best thing I can say about it is it's Richard Pryor doing Richard Pryor shit. So,
yeah.
I mean,
you know who used to do his voiceovers?
Richard Pryor?
Yeah.
Eddie Murphy?
No. The guy from Full House, not Uncle Joey, but Uncle, the cut it out.
Yeah, that was Uncle Joey.
No, Joey was,
No, John Stamos.
Uncle Jesse. That's right. Yeah, right. Sorry. Right. Yeah, Uncle Joey did.
Jesse and the Rippers.
Yeah, because it was what's his name? Something Quarter?
Dave Coulier.
Yeah, Dave Coulier. Yeah, yeah. He did ADR for.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
He tells the story. He's out there doing Richard Pryor.
Well, he did for a long time. He told the story on Arsenio.
That's funny as hell.
Yeah, where's Mon? A little What You Been Watching trivia. All
right.
Mark that one. So, anyways, but yeah, go ahead. So, Surviving Christmas. What was the takeaway from that movie? Does it apply to the holidays, or was it just a trauma?
That money solves everything.
Good takeaway.
If you have enough money, you can buy your way into happiness, because he ends up falling in love with Christina Applegate. They're together now, so it's this weird, like, and it's this weird dynamic because it shouldn't work at all. Like, she tells him this very personal, you know, like, they're having a moment, and he's like, you know, what's something that you remember from your childhood where everything was pure and you know, everything was good. It was the last time you remember not having any worries in the world, you know, like still having like the heart of a child kind of thing. And she tells a story about how they were in the park and one of the trees had frozen over and there were all these icicles dangling from it. And she just remembers standing underneath it and pretending that she was a princess in a crystal castle. And it was the last time that she remembers being really, really happy. So then, of course, later on a date, he takes her to a park. There's the tree, there's the icicles, whatever. And she goes to step forward and you know, check it out and be like, oh, my God, this is amazing. And then all of a sudden, this big brass band comes in and this foam Jesus comes down. And then there's carolers singing songs. And she's like, what the fuck is this big production? And he's like, I did this for you. This is your memory. Look, this actress looks just like you when you were 12. I found pictures and I made her get a haircut and yada, yada. And it's just this huge, big thing. And she's like, you idiot. You fucking ruined everything. But it's that type of like, that type of expectation or that type of like affluence where it's like, oh, well, all I got to do is just take this memory and make it big and grandiose. Like, throughout the entire movie, this Drew character just has a way of making everything about him, you know? And it's this weird, why would anybody tolerate that type of person, not just for $250,000, but, oh, by the way, now you can marry my daughter.
Yeah.
You know, like,
I guess he learned something about himself in the process of all this, but they kind of shoehorn it in at the end.
I don't know that he did, because he's still the billionaire account executive or advertising firm or whatever it is, but like the whole plot line is like rich white guy comes in and saves the middle class.
Wow. It, I mean, just on a, again, I'm not a rich man by any means, but like, this dude had to be off his rocker. Most rich people stay rich because they look at things like that and they're like, what's my return on investment on this?
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, Drew is clearly like rich enough to do what he wants, but he's impetuous and so self-absorbed that he can't be cared to think about the consequences. And I don't know that that changes. Like, at no point is there a big moment of like, well, I sure learned my lesson that money doesn't buy everything. Like, no, you bought your way into
exactly
Christina
what
Applegate's
you wanted.
Pants.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That's what happened.
It happens, man. We play a different game than the rest. So that's for sure, bro. That's for sure.
I don't know. It's a fun movie. It's a good premise. And like I said, I really think that Brian kid is the one to watch just because.
Shout out to him. Underrated performance of the week?
For sure. Why not?
Let's do it. Let's
if not him, who? You know?
Yeah, I don't know. I got nothing.
So anyway, I think that's all I got to say about it. It's just an awkward, like, how do I deal with not liking this guy throughout the entire movie? And then also everybody around him is kind of also exhausted by him at some point.
Yeah.
Like, why am I really rooting for this guy? Like, what's the point?
Right. Right. Yeah. They do have some unrelatable. So, like, what's their attempt to humanize him? Is just, oh, he had a damaged childhood or whatever?
Yeah, of course he has the big reveal of, like, oh, my dad walked out on Christmas Day when I was 4, and then my mom worked at the 24-hour coffee shop, and we never really had a Christmas, so every Christmas I would just come in and color on the mats and eat a stack of pancakes, and that was my Christmas. But he concocts this whole backstory of, like, oh, I had this grandpa, you know. I mentioned
candy cane and stuff. It's all BS. Yeah,
like you mentioned, exactly.
Yeah, I figured so. All right. Well, you know, there's the moral of that story. Just buy your way to happiness. What would you rate this movie?
I would rate it $250,000 is not enough to put up with Ben Affleck for 3 days.
In the real world, not just the movie.
Right.
Come on the show, please.
I don't know if that's true.
Yeah, I don't know. Come on the show, Ben. We can figure that out. Well, on that note, do you want to take a break before we come back? Or?
Yeah, man. Let's take a quick one.
All right. We are going to take a quick break from our sponsor, Christmas Tree Tinsels. They taste like coconut and as annoying to clean up as glitter. Christmas Tree Tinsels. We'll be right back.
Sponsors, Christmas Tree Tinsel. If you eat it, it makes your poop shiny.
It sure would. Oh man, that was a good one.
So my brother, we've heard everything about my holiday festivities. I've been flapping my lips for far too long. I got a question for you, sir. What'd you get me for Christmas?
Same thing I got you last year.
Dick and butter.
You're right, pretty much. Not in that order.
What you been watching, brother?
Oh, man. I have not indulged in quite as many holiday stuff as you have, or the ones that I have, we've just talked about so much that it's
right.
Just like I'm not bringing that up again. I will always bring up How the Grinch Stole Christmas because it's incredible, that cartoon. But before I get into what we both saw holiday-wise,
ooh.
I did finally get around to watching Hayao Miyazaki's Oscar-winning film, The Boy and the Heron.
Oh, The Boy, the Heroin, and the Baggy?
That's right. That's right. And the Narcan. No, it's actually, I got to say, I don't know if this is my favorite Miyazaki movie, but they don't often miss. Like, even a
sure.
lesser Miyazaki movie is still vastly superior to most.
I would agree with that. Even if it's not my favorite, it's still a pretty good piece of work.
Yeah, it's very deep. A lot of metaphors that are probably over my head. There's a lot, he uses a lot of symbolism and metaphors of this.
And a lot of it's based in Japanese lore and stuff like that. So if you're not familiar with the localized, you know, regional story that happens to take place in that particular part of Japan, like, you're going to miss a couple of things.
Absolutely. It opens, there's just animation sequences that are incredible, more on in a minute. But pretty much, it's kind of typical. I don't mean that like to be an insult, but like his big thing where I think he works best is typically he's kind of entered this phase of his career where this one is a lot like Spirited Away, mm-hmm. where, you know, your protagonist enters a very much so Alice in Wonderland kind of Wizard of Oz kind of situation,
right.
and has a guide.
Girl in a strange foreign land.
Yeah, yeah. Or this is a young boy, but
kind of. Sure.
Yeah, obviously, and the titular boy. So it's very much so like that, kind of Alice in Wonderland. He stumbles upon this tower that will take him to this land, and this heron promises that his dead mother is still there and everything. And so he ventures in, and then left is up and right is wrong, and whatever else is whatever else. Right. And
we're all mad here.
Yeah, kind of situation. And it's really, he really shines in things like that. And this one gets a little deep, obviously. There's like a as above, so below kind of situation where the things that are going on in the real world are kind of mirrored or a just different version of it here. So one of the people that dives with him into this realm is an elderly maid voiced by the incomparable Florence Pugh.
Nice.
And then she becomes in the other world when she kind of gets sucked in to this tower, like a kind of a seafaring pirate almost.
Okay.
And so that's kind of like her role on the other side. And,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So is it kind of like everybody, is it like Fantasy Island where everybody kind of gets to live out their true selves, quote unquote, or is it just like you're just cast into this random, like, oh, you're this version in this world?
I think it's more the latter. I mean, obviously it's premeditated by Miyazaki himself.
Sure.
But like without spoiling the movie, I'm going to have to a little bit. The movie opens with, he says 2 years before, or 2 years into the war or something like that. And then you see his house. The young boy is at a house and he looks out of the window and his dad comes running up and goes, "That's your mom's hospital. It's on fire." And you find out very quickly that the boy's mom passed away. So then he moves out to the countryside with his dad, who then begins to work in this factory making, it appears to be like the shells or the glass windows that go over the planes. And so they move out to this countryside or whatever, and dad has a new stepmom that looks just like his ex-wife, the boy's mom or whatever, and she's pregnant, and the boy is just kind of out of sorts. He's getting bullied at school, and so he finds reasons to stay home, and rich daddy kind of oversees that, I gave that school $300. That's all they cared about, da-da-da-da-da.
Okay. So, buying privilege and
stuff
like that.
Yeah, and all the while there's this gray heron that kind of taunts him and is like, we await your welcome, you are welcome to enter. And he howls mother at him a lot, "Your mother," and he tells him that his mother's still alive. So the boy,
goddamn talking herons, just can't trust them.
You really can't. And so the boy crafts a bow and arrow to go fight this heron. Turns out that's kind of his way into this world.
His Obi-Wan Kenobi into the, like, yeah. I will show you the ways.
Not really. He's more of a trickster. But
okay.
He's commanded by Mark Hamill to show him, to be his guide in this world.
Wait, commanded by Mark Hamill?
Pretty much, yeah.
Oh, I just made an Obi-Wan Kenobi connection.
There we go. But as you can see, I'm listing off all these names in typical fashion. If you've ever seen a movie like Princess Mononoke or anything like that, or Spirited Away, they get A-listers to come in and do the English dubs, and they do a phenomenal job.
Yeah, they do.
And, I mean, you got Florence Pugh is in there. Dave Bautista's in there.
I love Dave Bautista.
Yeah, more on him in a minute. But he plays the Parakeet King, which is awesome.
Nice.
Yeah, which is, again, some Japanese symbology of parakeets or whatever. But,
symbology?
I don't know, whatever. You know what I mean.
Symbolism.
I was thinking of a Prince album, musicology, whatever. I'm rolling downhill right now.
You know what? It's a word now. We're going with it.
Look, you know what I meant. I hate when people do that. But Dave Bautista is the Parakeet King, and Robert Pattinson is the heron.
Okay.
And so it's a really good cast, and just like they do with all these Miyazaki films, they get these A-listers to come in and just absolutely knock it out of the park. Like they had Billy Bob Thornton in
Princess Mononoke.
And Princess Mononoke. Yeah.
Billy Crudup, Minnie Driver was in that one.
Yeah, they have Christian Bale as the father in this one. So.
Oh, nice, nice. Yeah. He was also Howl's Moving Castle.
Yeah, he was, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, again, just A-listers all the way around that do a phenomenal job. And it's just kind of this entry into this world in this tower where the boy is looking for his now stepmom and then all these parallels of everything, and it's kind of fighting his own trauma and malice and things like that that he's harbored.
Okay.
And so it's really tough to explain without just watching the movie, but visually it's incredible. If you like Miyazaki in any fashion, form, or function, you're going to like this movie. I can see why it won Best Animated Feature.
Okay.
The way that the heron is done, he is not to be trusted, but at the end they're the only two that they kind of can trust. And he's one thing is creepy and freaky, and then once they get into the tower, he becomes far more comical. And it's a nice kind of change, and it makes me kind of respect Robert Pattinson, his acting ability, a lot more. And okay. I'm so glad that he really did break out of the Twilight box.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And is really kind of stretching his legs, just doing whatever the hell he wants.
I mean, dude was Batman, and he's going to be Batman again, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, he's pretty dang good actor, man. He's really good in The Lighthouse as well.
I will say, I do like him in that. I haven't seen a lot of the things he's been in. Like, admittedly, I watched one or two of the Twilight movies, and it definitely was not my jam.
I mean, he does what he's supposed to do in that, be brooding and dark and mysterious and like.
Yeah, it was a little heavy-handed in that one, though.
Yeah.
He was definitely like Robert Smith, but off the antidepressants.
Yeah. That's everyone kind of gives a flat performance in those movies, yeah. In my personal opinion.
I would agree with that.
I think, or
maybe not flat, but so stereotypical that there's nothing surprising about it. Like, oh, of course, you're that character kind
right.
of thing.
Right. So he's, and then you get to the great Dave Bautista, who we were talking a little bit off mic, which we'll bring to the air. Where do you think he's the best actor, wrestler, or wrestler turned actor now?
I do. I think that, I mean, let's face it, Hulk Hogan was always Hulk Hogan in every movie he's ever been in. Dwayne The Rock Johnson is just some version of
himself
Dwayne The Rock
at this
Johnson.
Point. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe you could do, what was it? Get Shorty? Too Cool.
Be Cool.
Be Cool. Be Cool. Yeah. But even then, he's just The Rock, but gay. And so what a stretch, you know? But yeah, I think Dave Bautista has really shown he's got comedic chops, he's got serious acting chops. You know, he can, of course, he could be the big muscle, the big muscle guy. But even that being said, like, he recently lost, I want to say something like 40 pounds, just because he felt that he was being typecast as, like, you know, the henchman or the big bad guy, or just, you know, we need some big muscle guy to, you know, the action hero.
The lovable buffoon, even,
yeah,
as he were in Drax
and
stuff.
So he lost like 40 pounds because he felt that it would give him more of an acting range, you know? So now he doesn't just have to be the muscle guy. Now he could just be the leading guy.
Yeah, no, good for him.
I got to respect that for him. He's a guy who came into acting and really dedicated himself to the craft, you know, like, he didn't just want to be another wrestler actor. He wanted to be an actor. And he's taken classes and he's expanded roles. I mean, like, his role in Blade Runner 2049, you know, he plays the scientist or the keeper of secrets or whatever. And, like, in that, he's still a big muscular guy, but he also has this real gravitas to his performance. You know, he's very sullen. He's very mournful because he sees how it plays out. You know, he knows that when he faces Baby Goose, that he's not walking out of this. You know, like, he's a replicant and he's spoiler, but he knows that it's the end for him. And so all he has to do is just protect this one secret. And there's a very sullen, a very macabre presence to his performance, you know, like, this is a man who is resigned to his fate, and he's perfectly capable of destroying, you know, this opponent, but why? They're just going to send another Blade Runner to kill him, another hunter, another this, another that. So his time has come, you know, and I think that there's a certain point where, I don't know, like, I just really appreciate people who go from one thing into another and completely devote themselves to that craft, you know? Like, he was a bodybuilder, and then he came into the wrestling world and dominated there, and then decided, well, I'm going to expand my repertoire a little bit. I'm going to go into acting. And then he took that exact same enthusiasm and dedication to work and being the first one on set and learning as much as he can, and then dedicated that into acting. And I think that's why he might be the best wrestler actor ever.
I think when you bring up Dave Bautista, I think that's fair. And this is a long way to just talk about his performance and how he stretched his legs in The Boy and the Heron. But just real quick, though, when he did his first movie in The Man with the Iron Fist, directed by the RZA of the Wu-Tang Clan, the Abbot of the Wu-Tang Clan, as it were, in the special features, the RZA talked about how he approached very much so. They're both big martial arts guys, and he always said that Dave Bautista approached his the way that he was on set and things like that with a very martial arts mindset. And that he was saying, he was praising him for how generous he was with his performance and his time. Really,
Dave Bautista was.
In order to make sure that he got the most, not only out of his, because they're scene partners a lot in that too, like they have a big fight at the end. And so he was very generous to make sure that RZA got what his actual vision was on film, which is very cool. Instead of just being like, I think the character should do this, he's like, what's your vision? Because that's what I'm here to execute. Very cool to hear. So, I could agree with that. John Cena certainly is up in the ranks too. But yeah,
I mean, he's good as Peacemaker. I would agree. Yeah. I think that John Cena has a lot better comedic chops than a lot of other wrestlers.
But back to it though. The Boy and the Heron. Really good. It's hard for me to really break down. I think it's a really good movie. Some of it was a bit over me. It pivots very quickly. Once you get into strange worlds, they don't tell you why things are the way they are. Apparently there are these pillars that need to be stacked every 3 days, and it kind of comes in the last 20 minutes of the movie, and you're like, okay. And like, okay. And Mark Hamill's character is the grand wizard behind the curtain of it all. And it's, you know, he's the great uncle of the main protagonist or whatever. And so it's very cool. There's a lot that happens. The animation is absolutely stunning. The plot is good, but again, it's just kind of confusing. There's so many things that they don't really explain. They just kind of are the way they are.
It's a magical, mystical world where anything can happen and the rules are not clearly defined.
Yeah, but you don't need, to enjoy the movie, you don't need them to define. I just don't want to sit here and pretend. I can go on YouTube and Google a bunch of stuff and being like, oh, well, they mean this with that. I don't want to do that because it doesn't come from me.
Sure.
There's things that I view that were very personal in the sense of just dealing with trauma, dealing with the way this young man goes about loss and the way that he chooses to confront things. The fact that he bravely goes to fight despite the fear, and just knowing that he has a sense of purpose. I don't know if I necessarily relate to it, but it's inspiring to see.
Yeah.
And just despite all odds, being like, I have a duty to try to investigate what this may be, not only for my mother who's passed away sake, but now in the sense of duty of my stepmom who's disappeared into this tower as well. And what does it all mean? And this heron keeps saying that my mother's alive and all this stuff. So to just kind of brave that is just kind of cool. So
right on.
I recommend it fully. Like it's well worth the Oscar. I just don't want to sit there and regurgitate a bunch of stuff that I YouTubed down the Japanese, as I'm going to say, symbology or the symbolism to sit there and make it my own thoughts. You know, I'd be doing y'all a disservice. So fully recommend it, though. Definitely worth a watch.
I mean, how does it rate in terms of a Miyazaki movie? Like, is it where would it slide into, it's better than this, but not as good as this?
I'm not as big, and I understand they play a role. I'm not as big on his stuff like Ponyo and things like that. My big two are Princess Mononoke and Spirited Away. Okay. And I think I'm in the minority in the sense of I like Spirited Away more.
Okay.
I do love Princess Mononoke, though.
Sure.
So, yeah. I mean, he has the other more child-friendly stuff, like Kiki's Delivery Service plays a... Those are phenomenal films
as
well.
Sure, sure.
But
I'll admit...
It's those, a different tone, though.
Yeah, yeah. I'll admit those are probably my least favorite. Like, they're fun, they're charismatic, and they're... But it's child fare. It's fluff, you know?
Yeah.
Like, for me, my favorite Miyazaki is hands down Grave of the Fireflies.
Yeah.
But I think I like that movie because it does tackle such really dark and macabre themes in an animation style, which I love the contrast of like, oh, we're just going to deal with death and loss and everything around you crumbling, but hey, we're going to make a charming, fun, animated kids movie as well.
Yeah, this isn't quite as kids movie like, but this is, you'll like this movie then. Like okay. I said, it's somewhere between Grave of the Fireflies and Spirited Away.
Not as dark as Grave of the Fireflies, but not as bright as Spirited Away.
Yes, I like the characters are a little better. I really enjoyed the heron in this one.
Okay.
But I really like the characters of Spirited Away a little bit more. That when gotcha. They like all the ins and outs of the people that come at the bathhouse in that movie, mm-hmm. I really think kind of make that movie a bit more vibrant.
Okay.
But here nor there, it's a really good movie. I do recommend it. And I will review it I will review it one hole in the beak of a heron costume.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure how that rates, but you've at least intrigued me.
When you see it, you'll understand. It means that it still works, but there's something you're not quite there. The magic isn't quite working.
Gotcha.
Let's just put it like that.
Okay, okay.
But it definitely deserved an Oscar, though. And I'm glad that Miyazaki got another one for that movie.
Of course. I mean.
So, with that being said, the other thing I watched is the other thing that you watched.
Yes, sir.
And this one's been a long time coming, and this is... We watched it closer to Thanksgiving,
mm-hmm.
but I think this movie, you could substitute Thanksgiving as the holiday that they're coming home for and replace it with any holiday, and it
sure.
works equally as well.
Right.
We watched...
Well, it's a great transition because it takes place over Thanksgiving leading into Christmas.
I think it's before Thanksgiving.
Yeah, yeah, it ends on Thanksgiving Day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. So it takes place before Thanksgiving, not the other way.
I guess you're right. Yeah, yes.
But either way, we are going to talk about Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, the great John Hughes film.
That's right. Starring John Candy and the incomparable Steve Martin.
Steve Martin, absolutely. This one is a classic amongst our household. Our dearest mother, she's a big fan of this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so this is probably,
makes sense if you know her.
Like. Yeah, it's probably her favorite Thanksgiving movie, which there's not a lot of... There's Thanksgiving movies out there, but this one is probably, I think, the standard. But you could, while we're in the holiday season, you could replace him needing to be home for Thanksgiving for any other holiday.
Right. Like Christmas, 4th of July,
yeah, whatever.
Arbor Day, whatever.
His daughter's wedding, whatever.
Right,
yeah,
right.
So. But what did you think about it? Because I got a couple thoughts I can spew off if you need me to.
I mean, it's a great buddy road trip movie. I mean, essentially, it's the Odd Couple meets the Open Road, you know? And so the dynamic between Steve Martin and John Candy is... It's just a delight to watch. The conflicting styles, like normally in any comedy duo, there's, you know, the physical guy, you know, the guy that's doing the pratfalls and the lovable buffoon or something, you know, the comedic, you know, the bent guy.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's the straight guy who's you know, the guy that's driving on the jokes and hammering home the punchlines and stuff like that. You know, like typically one does the setup, the other does the punchline. And in this dynamic, they both waver and waft between both roles, and they play off of each other so well. I mean, it's two comedic giants in their heyday. What could go wrong, you know?
That's actually in my notes. It's funny you brought that up. I said it's very, which I wasn't. I had to Google this part because I didn't know which one was which. But Laurel and Hardy is very much so like the Three Stooges.
Yes.
That was the reference I was going to use. But there's like, wasn't one of those other, I know it's not Abbott and Costello, but.
but also a good pull, Abbott and Costello.
Yeah, but like Laurel and Hardy, they had no straight man.
Right.
And in this movie.
Right.
Both of them get to be silly, and they both get to be the straight man in John Candy and Steve Martin. For example, John Candy gets to play with the broken car seat, you know, and I got a bad back, and he sits there and plays with it. And then when they switch over and he drives, Steve Martin then gets to play with the broken seat and go, oh, you broke the car seat. Oh, right. I didn't break it. How did it break? I don't know. And it mushes him up against the glass. So they both get opportunities to be silly in the same scenario, and neither one really upstages each other.
Right.
They also both get drunk at the end, and they're both are like very campy, like, oh, this feels like summer camp kind of mood. and they both have issues sleeping, you know, like, oh, I got to clear my sinuses or whatever. And his events as John Candy affect more Steve Martin's, but they both have their own qualms about what is and what isn't. Right, and so it's really a good dynamic.
It's between these two pillows. Those aren't pillows. Yeah,
he kisses his hand, but yet he's being cuddled. So it's like, why'd you kiss my hand? I don't know. Why are you holding me? Where's your other hand? Yeah. So that dynamic really does work in the sense of they both get to be slapsticky and, you know, they both can really bring down the house in terms of how serious they are.
They both also have that really, they both get a dramatic scene where they get to really show their character range. It's not just the slapstick. You know, Steve Martin has that thing, even though it's a little funny, where he's having a meltdown in the bus station or whatever.
Yeah, when he goes to pick up the car that's not there.
Right.
Before the great scene, which we'll talk about.
Right. And then, of course, John Candy has the, you know, like, I like me. My wife likes me. Yeah. People like me.
Yeah. But you know what I also do? I listen too much. Yeah. Which is a great monologue. I guess this movie kind of works in the sense of John Hughes, the writer, which I didn't know he wrote National Lampoon's Vacation.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that. That's how he cut his teeth.
Yeah, he had some hits and just the writing credit and producing credits.
He's one of those guys, again, like, he's been in a lot more things than people would recognize, you know? Yeah. Like, he's had his hand in stuff for a long, long time before he even came into consideration for, like, you know, The Breakfast Club and 16 Candles and all that stuff, you know?
But I do like the fact in this one, he was trying to work at a different pace because he was coming off of doing all the Brat Pack movies, which he's so well known for, like the Ferris Bueller's, the 16 Candles, the Breakfast Club, stuff like that. But his movies always had an increased, I guess, passion for teenagers.
Right.
And to humanize their struggles in a way that most directors just weren't really doing. And he tries to emphasize, like, the relatability of these teenagers. So now for him to take that skill set and to apply it to adults and one person who is simultaneously the most likable and affable human being, but also the most obnoxious human being ever, and a guy who is also simultaneously acts holier than thou and can't be bothered by certain things because he's made it into upper middle class now, and you can tell. Like, that's very important that
Steve Martin's character. Yeah.
And so, but he also
bumblefucks his way into it.
He's just as fucking dopey as, you know, and just in different ways. Like, their Venn diagram overlaps a lot in these two characters. Yeah. And it really works. And it's cool to watch him do that humanizing that he did of those teenagers into adults now.
Sure. So I had not thought of that. You're right. It seems like an easy transition to be like, oh, all the awkwardness and fear and anxiety and all that we feel as a teenager of, like, what's my place in the world? Like, that just continues when you're grown. Like, that doesn't, it doesn't really go away. You might get a little bit, like, better handle on it, but it's still going to peek through and rear its ugly head every once in a while where you're like, oh, fuck, I don't know what the hell I'm doing.
Yeah, and it's abundantly clear in Steve Martin's character, his ability to overcome adversity at this point. And he wants things to go. Like, he bitches about, he could have just, you know, got on the plane quietly, been like, you know what, I'm just going to take my L's and just get on the plane and just ride coach. And that's just going to be the end of this, you know? And he does, but not without, you know, making us think about it first. And he's lost a bit of his own, let's just call it entitlement. He's developed a sense of entitlement for certain things.
He always has to let everyone else know how they're inconveniencing him.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Yep. Whereas John Candy is just so helpful and so...
He says go with the flow a lot. He's like, go with the flow like a broken twig on the Mississippi or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, he's a people pleaser almost to a fault. You know what I mean?
He's eager to please for sure.
Yeah.
And part of that is, his own trauma that he has. But, you know, I mean, if you haven't seen the movie, we'll wait for 3 seconds for you to go watch it and pause it. So hang on. You back now?
That's right.
Phenomenal movie, right? Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. So, like, with his wife's passing and everything like that, his eager to please mode is on full tilt at all times, which, you know.
I mean, that's the whole impetus why he's on the road is, you know, if I never settle down, if I never go home, then I never have to go home to an empty house, you know?
Yeah, and we'll talk on that in a minute. I was going to try to stick this at the end. We can bring it up now. Steve Martin's road trip was made terrible after just 5 days due to his need to be with his family. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And John Candy's 8 years of being on the road was equally as terrible, but for different reasons. His was due to his lack of family. And so this road man technology, it's why he washes his stuff in the sink. He hasn't had a wife take care of him in years. You know, that's why he's developed all these slovenly habits, because he's in, he's out, he's gone, boom. And so his was more born out of survival and necessity. And that's why his is miserable, is he has no one. Steve Martin's is only miserable because it's just preventing what he wants. These are all just speed bumps in the way of getting to what he wants, which is to be with his family.
Right. That's a good point, actually. Yeah.
So it's which I appreciate it, man.
Same goal, different perspective a little bit, you know?
Like, yeah.
They both just want the family that they have, you know? Unfortunately, one way or another, life and circumstances prevent them from being with their family, you know?
And when we were talking about the entitlement earlier of Steve Martin, the entire first act is him just being chipped away at, until they finally have that, led to that iconic scene from John Candy where he's like, you know, people like me too. But before that happens, when Steve Martin rips into him about, like, you're like a Chatty Cathy doll, except you're the one pulling your own string. Just
right.
Yep. But that's the whole first act is him just being chipped away at and just being like, this is an inconvenience I shouldn't be tolerating.
Right.
But there's a force feeding of humble pie throughout this whole movie that makes Steve Martin's character, Neil, really, it doesn't shine until he finally begins to barter with the second hotel clerk when he ends up trading his $17 and his nice watch. And he says to the guy, like, please have some mercy.
Right.
You know, or something along those lines.
Right.
He appeals.
What is your humility worth? What is your dignity worth? You know, like, I just need a roof over my head. And for that, I'm willing to give away $17 and a Rolex watch, you know?
Yeah. And the forcing of haggling with this guy is, again, he's out of options. So it is one of desperation, too. But that is what I like to refer to as the force feeding of humble pie. It's just like, It ain't about you.
Right.
Life's going to life, buddy. What are you going to do to pivot with it? Like, are you going to let this off your pivot foot if we're making a basketball reference? Like, absolutely he does. And this guy, he's not adept at that. You know, he wants things a certain way because that's what he's grown accustomed to.
You can tell almost
without knowing, like, he didn't come from a lot, but he's made himself into something, or he's used to his upper middle class lifestyle.
Well, he's a control freak. You know, his character is very much used to, like, oh no, it has to be this way because otherwise I'm inconvenienced or I'm not getting what I paid for. You know, like, to him, there's always some disparagement of the social contract. You know what I mean? Like, there's always this thing that's like, well, that's not what I signed up for. So you have to make this right. Instead of just going like, I mean, listen, sometimes shit happens, you know, sometimes they don't have the car. Did you pay for it? Sure. Get a refund, go to a new car rental place. But he ends up making a big scene and, you know, calling, what's her name? I want to say Margot Martindale, but it's not Margot Martindale.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
Yeah. The secretary from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, you know, where she basically calls him an asshole, you know?
Yeah, you're like, fucked then.
Yeah. It basically says, you know, pound sand, you know,
yeah.
I could help you. And then John Candy steps in and he's complimentary and he's trying to, you know, hey, I know this is an inconvenience, but could you please help me? You know, instead of trying to focus on how are you going to make this right? He turns it into, you would be doing me a service if you did XYZ. And she's willing to help. And sometimes that's all it is. Like, it may be people pleasing, it may be pandering, but sometimes it's just, you got to play the social game. Sometimes we all have the social contract of like, I got my own fucking problems to worry about. I don't need you adding to the trauma and pile of shit that is my day.
No doubt.
So if you can just make my day, if you, as the person I'm interacting with, can just make the effort to make my day just a little bit easier, I'm willing to reciprocate, or I'm willing to at least hear you out and try my best to accommodate, as opposed to just like, well, fuck that guy, he's an asshole.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the underlying theme, that civility should be the starting point for everybody. You can dislike somebody all you want. Civility's got to be the starting point, you know, just what is this transaction about? Oh, it's about this. Okay, cool. Let's be civil about it. And we can get whether, I mean, if you want to go above and beyond, that's a different story. But, and it's funny that you bring that up. John Candy is probably, he's very relatable.
Yeah.
And that's why he knows someone in each town, is he certainly, probably for better or worse, apparently he can sell stuff because he can make an impact quick enough and then you don't see him again, but he does make an impact. Steve Martin learns that when you're around this guy for any extended amount of time, he will drive you up the fucking wall.
Right, right.
But John Candy knows someone in each town, and that really reflects on his ability to be relatable. And just a quick anecdote, something I was recently, I went to a car wash with my far better half, and we went to go pay for it or whatever. And the young man at the window, the kid at the window, we had dogs on the photo of our dogs on the card we were paying with. The first thing you do is, oh, I really like your dogs. And I keyed in on what he was doing. And it's you find something. If right. you're, you know, our cousin is an insurance adjuster or whatever. He says when he has to go to people's home, find something genuine. You can phone it in with the bullshit, but it may come across. People may sniff that out.
Right, right, right.
Find something you like. If it's college football, you may be wearing a Gators hoodie, and Lord knows I'm not a Gators fan, but we can talk college ball.
Sure.
I
go, right. College, how you think they're doing this year?
How's Florida doing this year? Right. What you think Billy Napier is going to stick around? Find something that you can find common ground on. And the young man at the car wash took it a little too far and just was just a little chatty. Nothing bad. Nothing like right, right, right. kept us for 20 minutes or anything, but wanted to then turn that into a story about his dogs or whatever. But it started from something that he found the common ground in. And that's the key.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's funny that as insufferable as he is in this movie, and he is, if you were in Steve Martin's, like, his role, you would be exhausted by dude as well, equally. Yeah. So I'm not saying that it's not without cause.
Yeah,
but
it's not unjustified, his anger and resentment.
Yeah.
But, like, he's also a little bit of a hard ass, you know?
Certainly. But if he is indeed as insufferable as Steve Martin claims, how can he garner so much favor from every person he interacts with in the... every person that he interacts with in all the cities that they end up going in.
Right.
Because what's the one thing he does? Oh, I know a guy sold him these shower rings and he can get us a room at the inn for whatever. Oh, he can book us a car. He's got pull with these people because he took the time to meet this person more than halfway, which is, again, more of just a lesson on life for me that I try to apply. I fall short of it, certainly. But there is something admirable about that. Some people are like, God, are you ever off? You know?
Right, 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 right. Well, there's also, I mean, in a weird way, John Candy is a salesman, but he treats the people he meets as if they're lifelong friends, whereas Steve Martin just goes through life and every person he interacts with is just transactional.
Right.
They're just temporary. It's
good
just,
word, transactional.
It's just, yeah, it's just, you're the lady that's selling me the car, or like, you're the innkeeper. And so, like, there's no connection being made, whereas John Candy takes the time to, like, get to know their kids and, hey, you know, when did you get married? How long you been married for? You know, how's your boy doing in college? That kind of thing. So, like, being a salesman, he's not just selling the product. He's selling himself as someone that they can trust, or somebody that's really is genuine about the things he says. But he's not being superficial or shady about it. Like, that's just genuinely who he is. Like, he wants to be your salesman, not just the salesman or a salesman. He wants to be the guy that you can call when you need shower rings. Hey, I know I got the guy on speed dial. I got him in my Rolodex, you know?
Right. Right. And it
Where
shows
Steve Martin is just like, you're just the next guy. You're just the next person. You're just whatever.
Like, yeah. It is. And like I said, we say all these things to show how opposite they are, but their Venn diagram overlaps so much. Mm-hmm. Not only in terms of like who they are, because certainly Steve Martin, like I said, in the performance wise, they both get a chance to go over the top,
yeah,
and be silly and like be the slapsticky physical one.
That scene where they get trapped between the two semi trailers.
Oh, hang on that, yeah, because I want to talk about the mess around. But yeah.
The scene where they get trapped between the two trailers and Steve Martin's driving. And he just looks over and they flash to John Candy and he's painted up like the devil and just laughing his ass off. Like, oh, it's so great. And it just happens for a split second. And then they cut back to Steve Martin just,
yeah.
That, The scene, they're driving down the road, and they're driving the wrong way on the highway, and the car next to him is trying to flash him down, like, you're going the wrong way. And he looks at John Candy, he's like, how the hell does he know where we're going?
He's drunk. He doesn't know where we're going. And he's like, yeah, how does he know our destination? He's like, okay, buddy.
That's right. The boozy sign. Yeah,
yeah, that's funny. No, there's a lot of great things. If you want to talk performance, I think a brilliant, brilliant performance is when Steve Martin does sound off on the lady when he comes back after spazzing out and having to walk across the terminal.
I want my fucking car.
I want your fucking company to get me a fucking car because the one that I was supposed to effing get. Yeah, and it goes off on and he enunciates every single syllable and ends with a strong, like, G-ing car because it's so good. That performance is really good. And my favorite, which I think is just absolutely, because it's a little bit understated and he didn't lean into full camp and just, is when John Candy does the mess around in the car.
Oh, yeah.
And he's playing the keyboard or the piano on the dashboard,
in the car alone,
smoking the cigarette. Well, I can talk about the nothing at the barbecue. He's sitting there blowing the horn. It's so subtle because it's almost as if, yes, the character doesn't want Steve Martin to wake up, so he's trying to keep him quiet, but he also does it with this weird thing of like, he's really into it.
Right.
It's almost like if you yelled into a microphone, but then in post, you turned it down. You know what I mean? It's like, it's subdued in a weird way where it's just kind of like, he doesn't want anyone to see him, but he's really enjoying himself. He's like, I don't want him to see how much fun. I don't think he would be mad at him playing along with the keyboard. I don't think he wants Steve Martin to see how much fun he's having performing this to himself, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's like, we've all been there where you're like singing in the car and you're jamming out. And then all of a sudden you pull up to a red light and you realize that everybody can look into your car and hear your music. So you kind of turn it down a little bit and you just kind of sit straight in your seat and you're looking forward. And then as soon as the light turns green, you're like, and I'm talking about them.
Yeah. Now just go watch that performance from John Candy. Do that in the vehicle, man. It's so damn funny. He's like leaning all over Steve Martin and stuff. He's swerving,
playing the piano on his leg and shit like that.
Yeah. That performance gets me every time. That little segment. So
yeah,
I forgot how funny that was to me. But in terms of that, I don't really got. There's a couple other lines that are really hilariously delivered all throughout. I like the. When they get picked up in Wichita by the guy that they sit in the back of the truck. This movie leans just enough into the cartoonish at times.
Cartoonish.
In the sense of like when they get out of the truck, when they're in the truck, there's a funny delivery. And I don't know why it's funny to me. He's like, what do you think the temperature is out here? And John Candy just definitively goes, I don't know, maybe one. It's such an odd number to pick. I don't know why the selection of the number one was funny to me, but it just is. And then when they get out of the truck,
because it's such an honest answer. Like he could have just been like, I don't know, cold as hell, you know, just give a generalized answer. But he actually thought about it. Was like, I don't know, one. Like, again, he's not trying to placate or you know, give you lip service. He thought about the question and gave a genuine answer.
Yeah, no, he does that a lot. You know, he asked him even before that. He's like, oh, how long do you think the roads will be? Ah, maybe 30 minutes. Or he's like, maybe 30 miles, no more than 35. Well, I guess depends which way he goes. I mean, if that, then it could be no more than 30 to 45. I mean, but if he takes the one way, it would be so less than 70 miles. It's like, dude, I don't care anymore. I was out after the first question, dude. But that's him being genuine. You know, he wants to give an honest answer. So even if he doesn't know what the hell he's talking about.
Right.
But I was going to say before we got off on that, it is cartoonish just enough in the sense of, like some of the slapsticky things that happen with like the car burning and like him being seen as the devil.
Right.
When they get out of the car and the back of the truck and the dog and them are all frozen solid. It's just cartoonish enough of like a little wink of kind of be like, we know this isn't real, but hey.
Right. I mean, it's something that could only take place within the realm of that movie. You know?
Right. Like, right. It's like, why wouldn't they be? But the truck driver, when he asks his wife to get out of the car and get their bags, they're like, no, we insist. He's like, nah, she's short and she's skinny, but she's strong. He talks about the first baby she delivered. Delivered the first baby sideways, didn't say a peep. The idea of delivering a baby sideways and not saying anything is very funny to me. It's a funny little joke in there. But yeah, it's a classic. I really don't have too much to say except just a lot of movies owe a lot to this.
Yeah.
And I know it's not the first road trip movie, but I don't think a lot of the Farley Brothers movie, like the Me, Myself, and Irene, Dumb and Dumber.
They owe a lot. They owe a lot. Sure.
The Bucket List is another one where kind of you get this dynamic matching up.
In a strange way, Twilight.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. Due Date, the Robert Downey, Zach Galifianakis movie owes certainly a lot to this.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's...
Sticks, the Heartfelt Landing, both of them do, certainly.
Yeah.
But apparently there's like a three-hour, like, they had more film. There's like a four-hour cut of this movie. Like, the original script was twice as long as it normally would be.
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
Yeah, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And they shot all of it.
Oh, I'm
and
sure.
And for the 35-year anniversary, which we probably should, hopefully by the time this comes out, we should probably get that for our mother.
Yeah.
But apparently a lot of those deleted scenes are in there. And when they shot it originally, they had zero interest in cutting any of it. They knew they were going to have to.
Right, right, right.
But some of it kind of works in its favor. Apparently, I mean, I'm going to keep just doubling down on this phrase now. The symbology of when they get off the bus, you know, because it breaks down or whatever, mm-hmm. and you see John Candy toting his heavy luggage. Well, he's literally, you know, carrying his grief around.
Right. He's carrying his own baggage.
His own baggage. And so what does Steve Martin do? He kind of helps him, lifts him up. And it's, you know, the load is lessened because sure. Steve Martin's character's there. And the smash cut to the end, when he comes back on the train rails, it kind of goes directly from them, like, why don't you come home with me? And then they smash cut to them both carrying that same trunk as they walk up to the house. That smash cut, apparently there's like several scenes between that. That just got cut. But because they knew that they had to come in on time, it kind of works.
Sure,
It's like a abrupt, like, we know everything we need to know about what happened between this time.
Right, right. The dynamic has been established at this point. We know who these characters are by the end, for sure.
And so that scene of them bringing it home, finally, and giving him home, it really... I can see why some people would cry at the ending, time in and time out. I think it was Matthew was telling us that one of his friends cries at the end of Planes, Trains, much like you do for A Wonderful Life.
I do. So. By the time he's running through the square, like, I'm the luckiest man. I'm like, you're right, George Bailey. You are so lucky. You're the luckiest man in town.
Yeah, man.
Zuzu's Petals. Yeah, man. I really don't have anything else to contribute. The only notes that I managed to take were... I have John Candy is amazing, and then underneath that, I have Steve Martin.
Quite in-depth notes, my friend.
I might have been a little bit strunctificated when I...
Or you just sat back and enjoyed it and just took it as it was and didn't have to do it
a little bit.
Two things can be true at once. Well, on that note, I guess that's time for us to... we are staring at a half-empty bottle of Courvoisier then, right?
That's right, baby.
Well, this is not obligatory because we do like saying this. Anybody that's listening, we genuinely appreciate you. We are incredibly thankful for you throughout the holidays. I hope everyone is safe. I hope everyone is sound. We hope you spent the time with people that you love, that it wasn't too stressful. And I hope you enjoy your holiday season and find some meaning in it all, truly. But until then, what I would do, if you're watching this during the holidays or you're rewinding and watching it, what I would do is I would watch a movie.
And go talk about it with somebody that you love. Also, money buys happiness.